Good evening, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know, addressing current questions related to novel treatment approaches for urothelial bladder cancer and prostate cancer. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Heath, and I will be your moderator for this meeting this evening. This are our faculty for tonight. We are splitting the session up to begin with bladder cancer, and I am joined on stage here with Dr. Terry Freelander and Dr. Matthew Galsky. Names that you all know. Here are a variety of our disclosures for this evening, and all of this information is also available on your iPad or if you're joining us online tonight through Zoom. The commercial support tonight is, again, as listed here, research to practice CME planning committee. Staff and reviewers have no conflict of interest to disclose, and we really welcome the educational grant from Astellas and Pfizer. Again, this educational activity contains discussion of non-FDA approved uses of agents and regimens. So please refer to the official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. So, in order to make this meeting more relevant to participants, that's all of us and all of you, there was a survey provided to 50 general medical oncologists conducted earlier this month. And these questions that were provided during the survey will be asked to our esteemed faculty this evening. And the full survey results are on the iPads and available in the Zoom chat room for your viewing. And I find that part of the discussion tonight is going to be very relevant for all of us in practice. So the agenda this evening, we are going to have four different modules. So really exciting because these are all relevant state-of-the-art changes and updates as you are learning along with all of us. Dr. Freelander will begin talking about antibody drug conjugates, especially in the frontline therapy for metastatic urothelial bladder cancer. Dr. Galsky, you're going to be talking about ADCs and relapse and refractory diseases. Later on, when our other two faculty persons are coming up, Dr. Armstrong will address treatment intensification and the AR pathway inhibitors in both non-metastatic and metastatic prostate cancer. And we will close out the evening with Dr. Agarwal talking about PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer. So, I think we are ready for Dr. Freelander to take us away.
All right.
Dr. Freelander?
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, everyone, for attending here and online. It's really a pleasure to be here today to talk about really some exciting developments in the world of bladder cancer. The landscape for bladder cancer has evolved really rapidly. When I started my career, we essentially had one drug. It was platinum, and it had some activity. It still does. But as you can see, beginning in about 2016, we had five new checkpoint inhibitors. We had a number of new agents approved, small molecule inhibitors of FGFR, like erdafitinib, enfortumab vedotin in late-line settings, which Dr. Galsky is going to talk about, avelumab maintenance, sacituzumab govitecan actually was conditionally approved, accelerated approval, and subsequently has had withdrawn its approval. The two agents I want to talk about really in more detail really is enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab, the EV-302 trial, and also we had an approval recently of nivolumab, gemcitabine, and cisplatin just recently as well. So, you know, enfortumab vedotin is a Nectin-4 targeting ADC, and I just want to step back for a second and say, why are we looking at Nectin-4? What is Nectin-4? In fact, Nectin-4 was only discovered about 20 or 30 years ago. It's relatively recent. They're transmembrane cell adhesion molecules. They're actually, Nectin-4 is overexpressed in embryology, and actually in adult tissues is not widely expressed. In cancers, it is highly expressed, and in bladder cancer specifically, but you can see here on the slide, also in breast cancer and in some lung cancers have overexpression of Nectin-4. If you look specifically in urothelial cancer, on the bottom left of the slide is about 500 or 700 patient samples that were analyzed for Nectin-4 levels, and you can see that Nectin-4 is fairly highly expressed across both localized bladder cancer as well as in metastases. And you can see that in the middle panel as well, most patients' tumors stain positive for Nectin-4. And on the bottom right of the slide, you can actually see that only a very small subset of patients have no Nectin-4 expression. So it's generally about less than 1%, or maybe around 1%. So this is pretty ubiquitous in urothelial cancer and is a good target for treatment. So enfortumab vedotin, as many of you may know, is an antibody drug conjugate. As I said, it targets Nectin-4. It has this payload of MMAE, monomethyl auristatin E. This is a microtubule stabilizer that by itself may be a little too toxic to give as free drug, but in combination is a good payload for antibody drug conjugates. So this is thought to be the mechanism of action of enfortumab vedotin. Basically, you can see the antibody on the left. When it binds to cells, which you can see on the right of the slide here, it gets internalized. The free MMAE is released inside the cell, binds to microtubules, and causes cell cycle arrest, and then apoptosis. So fairly straightforward mechanism of action here. Now, I won't say too much about this trial, the EV-301 study, because actually Dr. Galsky is going to discuss this, but this was the first approval for EV in the United States, and it compared enfortumab vedotin to an investigator's choice of either taxane or vinflunine. And just to cut to the chase, we saw a survival benefit, a median of about 4 months, a hazard ratio of 0.7, and this was enough to establish EV as an option for late-line bladder cancer. And as this data was being generated and came out, a number of investigators said, well, why are we looking at this in late-line settings? Let's look at this in early-line settings. And so specifically, we should also think about combining it, really trying to give our best therapies first. And so this is, I think, a good graphic of why we combine this. So EV plus pembrolizumab is listed here. You can see EV binds to the cells on top, actually causes cell apoptosis, but there's release of a number of immunostimulatory signals or damage-associated molecular patterns, which are the hallmarks of immunogenic cell death. And so if you're drawing immune cells into the microenvironment, it makes sense to then further stimulate them with a PD-1 inhibitor. And that was formed the basis for the initial development of EV and Pembro. So the EV-103 trial looked at this specific combination in two major cohorts, cohort A and cohort K. You can see the schema here, but essentially the drugs were given on a three-week cycle. What we saw in the cohort K, which was the largest cohort to date, at the time, was that almost all patients had some evidence of tumor shrinkage. The overall response rate was close to 65%. We saw a lot of complete responses, 10% in this initial study. And so this really gave us a lot of hope for a phase 3 trial. And you can see that responses were actually independent of PD-L1 status. So that really laid the groundwork for the EV-302 trial, which was first presented now about a year and a half ago at ESMO. This is a randomized phase 3, 886 patients, EV Pembro versus chemotherapy. It's important to note that chemotherapy was either cisplatin or carboplatin based for 6 cycles, while the EVP arms didn't have a limit for the dose number of doses of EV, and pembrolizumab was continued for about 2 years. So what did we see in this randomized phase 3 study? First of all, the baseline demographics, fairly balanced. I do want to call your attention to the fact that about 25 to 30% of the patients in the study had upper tract urothelial cancer, much more common in Asia. And then when we look at the distribution of metastases, about 25% of the patients had liver metastases. Liver metastases are a poor prognostic sign in urothelial cancer. Platinum chemotherapy does not work as well for these patients, and this is really an unmet need as we think about treating the disease. So the overall response rate in this study, to me, was very impressive. We saw, very similar to the phase 1-2, we saw 67% ORR, interestingly, almost 30% CR rate, and actually in the update, it's now above 30%, compared to a 44% overall response rate for chemotherapy. So almost, about 50% better in terms of ORR. What I think really turned heads was the PFS and the OS curves. And so here you can see that about 40% of patients had long-term durable benefit. You can see there's sort of a leveling out of the curve from the initial presentation. Hazard ratio here of 0.45, so that's less than 0.5, which we've never really seen in any bladder cancer study. So patients had a significant benefit in the EVP arm, and there was a doubling of the median PFS from about 6 months to over 12 months. The OS very much mirrored the PFS. We saw a hazard ratio here of 0.47 and also a doubling from about 16 months to a median of almost 32 months in terms of median OS. Now, this data, subset analyses were done, and I just want to point out that, first of all, every line on this graph is to the left, which favors EVP in the predefined subsets. So patients who had liver metastases seemed to do just as well as patients who didn't in terms of the OS benefit. And then patients who were eligible for cisplatin did just as well as the patients who were ineligible. In fact, the cisplatin ineligible patients may have done better, probably because carboplatin is not as effective a drug for those patients compared to cisplatin. But regardless, there was really benefit across a broad swath of patients in the trial. When we look at the toxicity, the story is a little different. You can see this is a tornado plot. It's not completely balanced. We see the toxicities of EVP, like peripheral sensory neuropathy, pruritus, alopecia, and rash, much more common. That's probably related to the distribution of Nectin-4. We don't see that so much with chemo, but we do see much more myelosuppression with chemotherapy, sort of a known on-target side effect, and EV doesn't appear to be very myelosuppressive based on the numbers that you can see here. There's an update that's actually being presented tomorrow, so this is incredibly fresh data that now brings the median follow-up into, I think it's the late, something like 28 months or so. And you can see the numbers really hold up here. I know this is a busy slide. Just focus on the hazard ratios on the right. If you look at the PFS and OS, they're still around 0.5. And in the specific subgroups, the hazard ratios hold up with, again, about a 0.5 hazard ratio across cisplatin-eligible, ineligible, and patients who have liver mets. So the question is EVP the new standard of care? I would argue it is. The NCCN guidelines have listed EVP as the preferred regimen for patients with frontline metastatic urothelial cancer. When I see a patient, I'm looking for a reason not to give this drug because it really should be the standard. We do have other category one recommended regimens. That includes Gem, Cis, and Nevo based on CheckMate 901, as well as the Javelin Bladder 100 regimen of upfront chemotherapy, followed by avelumab maintenance for patients with stable disease or better. So in the last few minutes, I want to talk about the toxicity of EVP, because there are very specific toxicities that I think are important to know if you're using this drug for the first time. The first is that Nectin-4 is widely expressed, especially in, I shouldn't say widely expressed, but it's expressed in the skin fairly widely. You can see in most other tissues actually don't have a lot of Nectin-4 expression. You can see this in micrographs. If you stain for Nectin-4 and if you stain for Nectin-4 and EV together, you can see that the drug localizes to the skin. This may explain some of the skin toxicity. Most of the skin toxicity is grade 1 or 2, but it can be of a variety of types. And I'm showing you the all the different types that are here. It can be mild rashes. There can be blistering rashes. There can be rashes that occur in the folds of the body, in the axilla or in the groin. What I really worry about is the severe rash, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, toxic epidermal necrolysis. Very rare, but it can occur. And so I counsel patients on day zero when I'm treating them that they have to be very careful about rash. If they have one, they have to report it. Fortunately, most of these rashes happen early, and usually that's an EV rash as opposed to pembrolizumab, which tends to happen a little later. But it's hard to distinguish between these, and often I'll refer my patient to a dermatologist to get a biopsy or help us think through what's causing the rash to know which drug to modify. For grade 1 rash, we can often continue therapy and just use high-potency topical steroids. I often give my patients a prescription for clobetasol or a similar steroid to take home with them and use for mild rash, but they have to call us and we monitor them closely. For grade 2, you want to consider a biopsy, consider systemic steroids, and hold drug until the rash gets better, close reassessment, and then reduce the dose from 1.25 to 1 milligram per kilogram. For grade 3, and you can see the criteria for grade 3 here, which is greater than 10% of the body surface area with fever, blistering, mucosal involvement, kidney or liver problems, this could be evolving TEN or Stevens-Johnson syndrome. You have to be very careful about these patients. These are patients you may want to hospitalize, get dermatology involved, stop the EV and give intravenous corticosteroids and monitor them closely. Most rashes do get better in the 301 trial. About 11% of patients had dose interruption and about 4% stopped permanently. It was a lower rate in the EV-302 study. I list the dose modifications here on the right, and these are, I think, very helpful. They're really essentially a 20% dose modification at each level. Sensory neuropathy is a major issue for EV as well. Fortunately, most patients have grade 1, but about 25% of patients can have grade 2 or higher. Grade 2 means that you can't button your shirt easily, you can't use a fork, can't tie your shoes. So that can be a serious problem. Usually this onset is later than the skin rash, you know, at month 2 or month 3. Often can improve with dose reductions, but I think early recognition is key. I think if you keep giving drug to people who have bad neuropathy, it'll get worse, and we have to be really careful about that. And I also want to remind folks that motor neuropathies can occur as well. So I have patients walk for me in the clinic, and I see what's their gait like. You know, I ask their caregivers, are they having trouble, you know, moving, et cetera. There's eye toxicity that can happen. This is less common, front of the eye keratitis, and that can usually be treated with lubricating eye drops or ophthalmologic steroids. And then hyperglycemia is a class effect of MMAE. There have been deaths due to diabetic ketoacidosis, so I don't give EV to patients with a hemoglobin A1C greater than 8 or a blood sugar greater than 250. So diabetes management is really important. So the summary is listed here. Neuropathy and rash are common. You have to know about these. Education and monitoring the patient and the caregiver and your nursing team, and anyone seeing the patient is really important as well. I have a low threshold to take a dose break, dose reduction, dose delay early, especially for neuropathy. Most of these adverse events will improve, but again, caution with using this in diabetics, especially if their A1C is greater than 8 or blood sugar is high. We don't want to use that. Now, there's not enough time to talk about every trial that's upcoming. There are a lot of ADCs being pushed into the front line. I've listed some of them here. I think you can come back and we can talk about this maybe in the discussion.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe a great place to even end here, but yes. I know you have one more slide.
Yeah, I have one last slide. Yeah. This is my key takeaway, really, is how will I treat patients in 2025? Mm-hmm. I think EV Pembro should be preferred. Patients who progress should probably get platinum. If EV is unavailable, then Gem/Cisnevo is a reasonable option. If the patient's not eligible for either, then Carbogem would be reasonable, followed by Avelumab maintenance. And you can see some of the options in later line settings listed here on the slide. So with that, I'm going to stop, list my conclusions here, but I think there's a lot more we can discuss in just the coming minutes.
You know, I can't believe we're having so much to talk about in bladder cancer. I think those of us who do see bladder cancer in our practice are just thrilled that we have these options, that we can talk about these things. But to try to integrate them into our daily sort of routine, this is exactly the type of questions that face all of us in practice. So here's the first one, Dr. Freelander. Honestly, you ended there. In what case would you pick one over the other? And that's a common scenario. You see a newly diagnosed metastatic bladder cancer patient who's, let's say, great performance status. How do you decide?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a number of factors. I actually think a lot about the toxicity of EV. So if a patient has bad neuropathy to begin with, it will likely get worse with EV. So we have to be cautious about recommending EV in those patients. I think carboplatin, gemcitabine, followed by avelumab is a reasonable regimen for them. Cisplatin, maybe not so much. I think if patients have diabetes, as we've been talking about, with a hemoglobin A1C above 8, I avoid giving EV in those patients. I think patients with variant histology, I don't think we know as much about what to do for those patients. There's some data from the UNITE registry that suggests that responses to EV are not as good in patients with a variant predominant histology. Mm-hmm. And for those patients, I might give gem/cisnevo, or I might give gem/carbo and avelumab, depending on their tolerance. So those are kind of like three scenarios where I think EV is probably not the right choice for the front line.
Well, the second question is one that faces all of us, because as all of this was going on in the metastatic setting, adjuvant studies were also underway. What are your thoughts there in terms of how do you make a decision on what's next as first line if somebody has already received adjuvant therapy?
Yeah, this is a great question. We don't really have great prospective data looking at this. Yeah. In kidney cancer, there have been two randomized phase 3 trials that show that giving a second PD-1 agent after a first is not effective. We probably shouldn't be doing that in RCC. Yeah. Is that true for bladder? I think maybe yes. There was some data presented also through the UNITE registry that looked at the activity of EVP in patients who'd already had a prior ICI, immune checkpoint inhibitor. The response rate was about 40%, which is what you would expect from enfortumab vedotin by itself. Yeah. So I'm not sure we get a lot out of giving the second agent, the pembrolizumab. I've done it. I still do it in some patients because, you know, if you really believe that there's immunogenic cell death and that EV and pembrolizumab have some sort of actual synergy, hard to prove, but there might be a rationale to do it, but we need the studies and the prospective data to understand it.
How about you, Dr. Galski? That third bullet, you know, that's another patient type that we see in our practice. What if they're just in general ineligible for IO? What do we do with EV?
So we certainly have data for EV in the frontline setting in cisplatin-ineligible patients, and we have data for frontline platinum-based chemotherapy and switch maintenance, in second-line EV. Right. And so I think both of those are options. And, of course, for our patients with metastatic urothelial cancer, we do try and optimize the number of potentially effective regimens that they might be able to receive. So ultimately, that question oftentimes is not a matter of which, but it's a matter of when and what you're going to use first. And, yeah. But both classes of drugs play a role.
I think that's some of the all this great data, but when we're asked to figure out what we need to do in our practice come Monday morning, it really is a bit of a challenge. And here's a classic sort of scenario I think that faces us from this also terrific question from one of our survey respondents. You have an 81-year-old female who's frail, presented with some urinary retention, 8-centimeter mass, and oh no, it's a lot. It's a large mass with squamous features. The TMB score is 6. MRI showed the tumor invading into the suprapubic bone. Bone biopsy was negative. CT showed some small lung nodules, the dreaded just little bits everywhere and not big enough to biopsy. What should we do at this point? Is there a recommendation? And Dr. Freelander, what are your thoughts here on this sort of scenario?
Yeah, this is a really good question because it's not super clear what the right answer is. You know, we say frail, but what does that mean? Does that mean she's using a cane to walk in the clinic or is she in a wheelchair and not able to walk? So we don't really know that. For the very frail patients, I still use pembrolizumab monotherapy as a frontline option. I've had a few successes there, but the overall response rate's only about 20%. So you have to really counsel the patient that the likelihood is that they won't respond to single agent pembro. I've also started in patients like this low dose EV, so EV 0.75, as a sort of a test dose. And I actually tell the patient that we're going to try this and see if it works. And so I really try to have an informed discussion with them. I'm a little concerned that there's squamous features, because that UNITE data that was presented at ESMO recently, and I think it's being updated at this meeting, suggests that EV is not as effective in patients with squamous histology or squamous variant. So that makes me a little concerned. Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, I'd have a discussion about pembro mono versus pembro plus maybe a reduced dose EV, see how they tolerate it, and then make a decision on day 8.
Yeah. Dr. Galski, thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is a patient where really discussion about goals of care is required and what's the tolerance for treatment-related side effects versus achieving a response. Yeah. This patient needs a response to treatment for palliation. They have a large primary tumor. They're going to get into problems with bladder outlet obstruction and renal failure, probably pain from involvement of the bone. And so the likelihood of a response to single-agent pembro is not zero by any means, but it's low. Yeah. And you probably only have one shot at trying to decrease the tumor burden. And so I think for someone who's informed and really wants to use the regimen that has the most likelihood of benefit, this strategy of using potentially a little bit lower dose EV makes sense.
Well, and I'll ask you, Dr. Galski, we've had conversations, you and I, about what to do with this concept of MRD or minimal residual disease that's honestly facing all of us. So, you know, we know molecular testing is in the space of bladder cancer really almost every day because of other drugs that can respond, especially in the FGFR pathway. But how are we using MRD to figure out, do we use it to stop? Is it a measure that's consistent enough? It certainly is a struggle in my own practice. What are you doing?
Yeah, I don't think we could use it to stop. It's a good research question. There have been proposals to design the very study that's being, you know, that's addressing the question raised here. But there are challenges to doing that. So I think it's interesting, but certainly not ready for prime time. I think from a practical standpoint, the question becomes, why do you want to stop? And that might sound obvious, drug-related toxicity, cost, et cetera. But when you have a patient with metastatic urothelial cancer as a CR after 2 years of treatment and is tolerating treatment well, that patient oftentimes is very hesitant to stop. So academically, it's a great question, can we stop? But in reality, it becomes a challenging conversation to stop this treatment that's been so effective. In the setting of treatment-related toxicities, it becomes a little bit more straightforward. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Freelander, how are you using MRD testing in your practice?
Yeah, so we're using cell-free DNA. We're trying to get this in most patients who have metastatic diagnosis and then monitor it. You know, again, it's not really been prospectively validated as a tool to tell us exactly when to stop. Trials could be designed that way, but they're, I think, logistically hard to accrue to because most patients who are responding to drug, if their cell-free DNA goes negative, they may not want to stop, right? This is a life-saving therapy. And so it's a hard study to do these. It's hard to do these discontinuation studies. All that said, I've had patients who have toxicity for one type or another, have reached CR and have had negative cell-free DNA. And so it's more of an art than a science at this point where we are in 2025. But if you put that all together and the patient is really ready to stop, I think that gives me more comfort in stopping.
Yeah.
But a lot of caveats attached to that.
I think that's the right messaging. It's nice to have a conversation. I think within the three of us, we probably have a different way to utilize testing in our own practice, and it's certainly very individual dependent. So I think more to come, I hope, and that's really exciting. Another question from our survey respondents, when administering EV Pembro, if you hold or discontinue the EV for toxicity, do you also stop the Pembro? Certainly a question that comes up a lot. Or do you continue Pembro as a single agent until progression or toxicity? Dr. Freelander, you touched on this just a little bit in your discussion. What do you think?
Yeah, so there's not really good prospective data about whether to stop the Pembro or continue the Pembro. Most people who get past the first 6 months of immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy, PD-1 therapy, if they're going to have a side effect, it's probably happened. It's not true for every patient. There are rare side effects that occur after the six-month mark. Most patients in my experience who had needed to hold the EV want to continue the pembrolizumab. And, you know, most of the trials have allowed, for example, EV-302 allowed up to 2 years of therapy. So there are actually a fair number of patients in EV-302 who stopped EV and continued the Pembro for up to 2 years. In my practice, you know, in the early days, I've had at least one patient who's been on for Pembro for more than 4 years. And it took a lot of work to convince them to stop, fortunately still in a CR. So I think until we have better data that tells us to stop this drug earlier, we should keep giving it. There is financial toxicity, whether it accrues to the patient or to the payer, you know, is a good question. But I don't think we have a right answer here. And this is not unique to bladder cancer. There's, you know, really, could you ask this about any IO combination that exists across oncology?
Yeah. And it's certainly for a lot of us who do clinical trials, when you have two drugs, you're trying to make an attribution, it gets really tricky. And then you realize, wow, that's on a trial setting where we have some guidelines. You know, in real practice, it's not something that's always front and center. I know that you spent some time discussing the cutaneous toxicity. I think one of my questions to actually both of you is, this is the type of management that requires multidisciplinary care. So it's not just the physicians who are prescribing this, but other team members that may need to recognize the cutaneous toxicities. So I think there's two things, you know, how do you manage this within the multidisciplinary setting, and what kind of dose adjustments are you doing? I think you mentioned a little bit of that. So if you wanted to repeat that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I try and follow the guidelines, actually very good guidelines that were developed during the trial, and I try and stay to that. So it's a lot about assessing toxicity, you know, grading it. Grade one, I think you can continue drug. So if they have a mild, you know, erythematous rash, you know, I said already that I give them steroids, high potency steroids on day zero to the patients who I think can understand how to use this appropriately. Yep. And we do teaching with nursing, et cetera, to make sure they understand how to use that. Mm-hmm. And then they call us. But I do worry. We had a patient on the trial who had, you know, a blistering rash. This was reported. He ended up in the hospital, actually recovered, but needed IV steroids. So it really does happen. Yeah. And I think we have to be really careful about it. And I mentioned a little bit that the EV rash tends to occur soon. So, you know, we've seen rashes occur within just days of the first dose. Not that they can occur later, but the pembrolizumab rashes, in my experience, happen later. We do see some pruritus from pembrolizumab early. Mm-hmm. So making that attribution is tricky. Getting a biopsy, I think, is helpful. And then once it happens, I would follow those guidelines. And so if it's grade 2, then you want to reduce the dose. If it's grade 3, you want to consider stopping the drug permanently.
Dr. Golsky, similar in your practice?
Similar. I similarly advocate for doing the biopsies. I think that it's certainly a luxury to have a dermatologist that you can refer your patient to, see your patient quickly and consider doing a biopsy. So I recognize that. That said, you know, I've seen rashes across the board, and the biopsy is often helpful in adjudicating the rash. I just had this happen within the past week. We weren't sure what it was from. Ultimately, biopsy comes back, and it was a psoriatic-type rash under the microscope, more likely to be related to Pembro than EV, and that's helped us in terms of which drug to stop.
So to make this as practical as possible, Dr. Freelander, I'm going to put actually both you and Dr. Golsky on the spot. We have a question from our virtual audience, and it's really in your conclusion slide, we have three options nowadays. Mm-hmm. So it's either EV Pembro, it could be chemo followed by maintenance of avelumab, or gemcitabine/nivo. What is your guiding principle when you're seeing this patient in clinic Monday?
Yeah.
What are your thought processes?
I mean, I try and talk to them about all the trials if I have the time or all the data. Mm-hmm. But really, I think patients are coming to us for a recommendation. And so I generally lead off with EVP. It is the preferred regimen in NCCN. If the patient's eligible for it, I think they should get it. You know, we have frontline clinical trials, so I may talk to them about things like that. Mm-hmm. But I do think, as I said earlier, that we want to like assess the patient and decide, are they fit to get EVP? Do they have an autoimmune exclusion, bad neuropathy, bad diabetes, maybe a skin condition that would make you concerned? I think that's pretty rare. So I really look for those and then make a decision. And if they don't have any of these really bad pre-existing conditions, I really tell them EVP is the right way to go. If they do have an exclusion, then I think through gemcitabine/nivo or, you know, maybe gemcarbo and avelumab.
So you really follow the NCCN guidelines in this instance, which I think is helpful for our audience. Dr. Golsky?
Yeah, I agree with that, although I would say that, you know, this is complicated, and it's actually more complicated than just these three considerations, right? Because patients develop metastatic disease coming through different paths, so to speak. You know, most patients do not present with de novo metastatic bladder cancer. That accounts for about 5% of patients. Most patients present with clinically localized disease and then develop metastatic disease. So patients could get neoadjuvant chemotherapy, adjuvant nivolumab, and then develop metastatic disease. Right. They might just get adjuvant nivolumab and develop metastatic disease. So your patient who is treatment naive with metastatic bladder cancer could have received prior treatments earlier in their disease course, and that completely influences your recommendations.
Yeah. You know, I'm just wondering, I mean, yes, they're listed that way in NCCN, but they're all technically category one, strong data for all.
Yeah.
So does the data guide us here in this instance?
Well, you know, I would be very clear about what category one means in NCCN. I'm on that panel. Category one means that there's a randomized phase three trial that shows its effectiveness. It doesn't say between two category ones that one is better or worse. And that's why NCCN has these listings of preferred regimen, other recommended regimen, or useful in certain circumstances. And I think that's why you see the splay where EVP is preferred, because if you look at the totality of the data, the OS data, and ORR, you know, the data is quite strong for EVP. It's not to say that it's not strong and the other regimens aren't beneficial. I've had patients have durable responses to avelumab as well. Yep. But I think that we have to be careful about how we interpret that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a helpful discussion. It's nice to have options. And I think here we're going to move on to learn about the evidence that backs the use of ADCs in relapse or refractory metastatic urothelial, and sort of a next step from our earlier teachings from Dr. Freelander. So, Dr. Golsky?
Thank you. So Dr. Freelander alluded to this already. This is the EV-301 study, really the first phase three study in bladder cancer testing an ADC. It was an ADC versus investigator choice chemotherapy, docetaxel or paclitaxel, mostly in the United States, vinflunine, of course, a novel vinc alkaloid available outside of the United States. So a randomized study. Remember, this occurred after enfortumab-vedotin had accelerated approval in the United States based on single-arm studies in response rate endpoints. So this was the definitive study. And one of the reasons that I'm showing this after Dr. Friedlander already showed it, because we have longer-term follow-up data. And what I want to point out here specifically is that, you know, we think about this tail on the curve with immune checkpoint blockade. We think about the sort of profile of immune checkpoint blockade, maybe response proportions that are not the highest as a single agent, but very long response durations and potential durable responses. And I was somewhat surprised with antibody-drug conjugates, what we ended up seeing in terms of their profile. I thought that maybe less toxicity, similar activity to the other drugs that we had available in terms of cytotoxic drugs, but clearly that's not the case, both from a toxicity standpoint, but from an efficacy standpoint as well. So if you look at the progression-free survival curves here, look at the number of patients who are out at, you know, 2 years, slightly more than 2 years, without progressing. These are patients who've already received chemotherapy and immune checkpoint blockade. So a subset of patients do have durable disease control with single agent enfortumab vedotin. And then you can see the survival data with longer term follow-up holds up quite well. So ADCs are here to stay in bladder cancer, and now we start thinking about what's the next target. And HER2 has been studied in bladder cancer for a long time. There are decades of studies testing anti-HER2 based approaches, really trying to target the kinase activity of HER2, or using naked antibodies directed against HER2 in bladder cancer, really showing limited to no activity. So this target really was felt to maybe not be the best target in bladder cancer after all of that experience. And it's certainly been revived in the antibody drug conjugate era, because we know that HER2 is overexpressed in a subset of bladder cancers. And even if we don't completely understand the relevance of signaling downstream of HER2, it is a pretty good target for selective delivery of cytotoxic agents. When we look at HER2 expression in bladder cancer, you know, surprisingly, if you look at the literature, it's across the board. Like, you can find papers saying it's 5%, and you can find papers saying it's 90%. There are multiple reasons for that. This is one of the better older data sets that we have, because it was one of the few data sets where HER2 was actually assessed centrally in the context of a clinical trial. And for those of you who remember this, this was an active cellular therapy directed against HER2. It was the HER2 version of Provenge. And this was an adjuvant study. And in this adjuvant study, patients with bladder cancer after radical cystectomy were potentially eligible based on HER2 expression, so there was central assessment of HER2. And you can see the distribution, either based on the primary tumor assessment or the lymph nodes, HER2 expression based on immunohistochemistry. And you see that about 80% of patients have at least 1+ expression, and then the 2+ and 3+ is a little bit different based on primary or metastatic disease. We think that HER2 may be a little bit higher expression in metastatic lesions. This is a more contemporary data set. This is a Sloan Kettering experience. And the numbers line up pretty well. You know, only about 20% of patients have zero expression on their tumors. But one of the reasons for showing this is that with next generation sequencing being done more and more routinely, we're picking up HER2 mutations and HER2 amplifications, and those actually correlate pretty well with HER2 overexpression at the IHC level. So you see the 3+ in the stacked bar chart, and you see that among the patients with HER2 mutations or HER2 amplifications, most of those patients have HER2 overexpression at the 3+ level based on immunohistochemistry. One of the challenges with HER2, of course, is that all expression isn't created equally. So there are, as many of you know, different scoring algorithms for breast cancer and gastric cancer, because the patterns of staining are different in those two different malignancies. And in bladder cancer, it's also different from those two malignancies. So in bladder cancer, you tend to see membranous circular expression, but it tends to be patchy. And so that has some potential implications, not only for testing, but for antibody-drug conjugates as well, particularly for the linkers. And so we don't have a specific scoring system for HER2 in bladder cancer right now. Some studies have used breast. More recently, most of the studies are using the gastric algorithm. What I was mentioning about the linkers is that if you have patchy distribution of your target and you give an ADC that has a non-cleavable linker, then you're probably not going to get a lot of bystander effect, and so you might have limited activity. And that's actually what's borne out with T-DM1. We have two studies with T-DM1 in bladder cancer. They're pretty small studies. One study showed no activity at all. The other showed a little bit of activity. And so maybe there is something to this concept that that you need this bystander effect with a cleavable linker. The two drugs that I'm going to talk about, trastuzumab deruxtecan and disitamab vedotin, both have cleavable linkers. So they're both ADCs directed against HER2. One of them is a trastuzumab-based antibody. The other is actually a novel antibody directed against a different epitope on HER2. And then you see the payloads are different. For trastuzumab deruxtecan, it's a topoisomerase payload. And for disitamab vedotin, it's MMAE, the same payload that we just heard about for enfortumab vedotin. And there are other HER2 ADCs on the list here where there is actually data that's in the public domain in bladder cancer already presented. So we have an approved ADC directed against HER2 in bladder cancer, and that is trastuzumab deruxtecan based on the tumor agnostic indication. So T-DXd was studied in the PanTumor02 study. You see all of the tumor types explored here, and bladder was one of them. And if you look at the patients with bladder cancer, somewhat of a limited sample size, but if you look at the all comers, which were mostly 2+ or 3+ expressing tumors, response rate was 39%. And in the 3+ group, which is a small sample size, 56%. These are patients who are retreated already with standard treatments for bladder cancer. And so a respectable response rate in that heavily pretreated population. If you look at the whole study, you see that in this experience, there does seem to be some correlation between the level of HER2 expression based on IHC and the likelihood of response. So potentially a biomarker that helps us identify who's most likely to respond. When that was looked at in terms of time to event data, you don't see that much difference between the 2+ and the 3+, but remember, these are small sample sizes. Trastuzumab deruxtecan has a somewhat unique side effect profile. So unlike EV, which we've already heard about, more topoisomerase-related side effects. You have cytopenias, you have GI side effects, and then you have ILD, you have pneumonitis as well. ILD is not common, as you could see on the slide here, but it is potentially serious, and it is an adverse event pretty much from every ADC that we give, but more common with some than others. So this is something that we look for when we treat patients with T-DXd. I mentioned that HER2 mutations occur in bladder cancer, and HER2 in trastuzumab deruxtecan has been studied in a basket study in patients with mutations as well, so separate from IHC overexpression, enrolling patients based on the presence of mutations, in part because of the correlation with overexpression. And there were patients with bladder cancer enrolled in this basket study as well. You can see the activity in these plots, and you can see the relatively small urothelial cancer cohort, but most of the patients treated in that cohort had some regression of tumor on trastuzumab deruxtecan. So something to think about when you do next-generation sequencing. You have a patient come back with a HER2 mutation or an amplification. Certainly that should trigger IHC testing if it hadn't already been done. The other HER2 ADC that I'm going to talk about is disitamab vedotin. Remember, this has an MMAE payload, same payload as enfortumab vedotin. So there's a pretty large experience with disitamab vedotin now because this drug has been developed in China for some time. And so this is the experience in China with disitamab vedotin pooling two phase 2 studies with pretty similar eligibility criteria. So this is the experience in patients who were mostly heavily pretreated with metastatic urothelial cancer with either either 2+ or 3+ expression of HER2. And you can see that the response rate of 50% in this population, again, pretty high for a heavily pretreated population with some deep responses there. We even see activity in 1+ expression, as you can see in this smaller cohort, and even a little bit of activity in patients with HER2 zero expression, which really highlights the fact that there probably is some inter and intratumoral heterogeneity in expression, and probably depends a little bit about on where the biopsy comes from. So now we have these different ADCs. Some of them are directed against the same target. Some of them have the same payload but different targets, and we can start to compare across these in terms of the side effect profiles. And you can see that the side effect profiles are somewhat target-driven and somewhat payload-driven, and they don't match up exactly between drugs. And we've already spoken about EV. We've spoken about trastuzumab deruxtecan in terms of the potential for pneumonitis. And disitamab vedotin, the AE profile, similar to EV, but seems to be a little bit different in terms of some of the side effects like hyperglycemia, rash, neuropathy still potentially occurs with disitamab vedotin. Trastuzumab deruxtecan has been combined with nivolumab. Actually, we had data with trastuzumab deruxtecan and nivolumab before we had single agent data in urothelial cancer, just based on the timing of how the studies were done. This was a much smaller experience, and you see when you combine trastuzumab deruxtecan plus nivolumab in this heavily pretreated cohort, a response rate of 36.7%, not the 60 to 70% that we've seen with some of these other combinations, and whether or not that's just based on the fact that these patients are heavily pretreated, based on the fact that it was a very early experience, hard to know for sure, but this is a small sample size, and we'll need larger sample sizes to make some more realistic conclusions about those combinations. We do have data with disitamab vedotin in PD-1 blockade from China. This was updated at ESMO, and you can see really high response rate in mostly untreated patients, but some patients had one or more prior lines of treatment. Response rate is 75% here. So this regimen, like EV Pembro, really looking quite active. Disitamab vedotin, also known as RC48, is now being developed internationally, and here's the design of the RC48 G001 study. There are cohorts in patients who have previously been treated with standard treatment. Those two cohorts include single agent therapy in patients with lower HER2 expression and higher HER2 expression, and then in untreated patients, there is a randomized study of disitamab vedotin versus disitamab vedotin plus pembro versus disitamab vedotin monotherapy to really understand contribution of components in that frontline setting. And we have some preliminary data from the safety run-in of that study presented at ESMO this past year with a response rate of 66.7% with disitamab vedotin plus pembrolizumab. So lining up really with what we're seeing with DV plus toripalimab based on the studies done in China. I was alluding to this a little bit, whether or not there's something special about MMAE where we're seeing higher response rates with those combinations versus the topoisomerase inhibitor combinations with immune checkpoint blockade. Maybe there's something here. Maybe it's just noise based on small sample sizes and the difference in untreated patients versus patients who have been previously treated. So in summary, EV, single agent durable activity in a subset of patients. HER2, probably a complicated target if we're trying to target the kinase activity of HER2, but certainly a validated target now for selective delivery of therapeutics. And this raises a bunch of just practical questions in terms of sequencing of therapies, how we best test for HER2, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Dr. Galsky. It's exciting to hear about all the developments, especially in the ADC space. You know, I think we've had experience where perhaps there was some disappointment that happened way in the future. Do you think there are some lessons learned from that to help guide perhaps some of these newer generation ADCs?
Yes, I think we have to pay attention to toxicity. And we have to pay attention to the fact that even though sometimes ADCs are being developed in a tumor-agnostic fashion or across multiple tumor types, patients with urothelial cancer are a bit different. We have an older patient population. The median age of diagnosis in the United States is 76. We have patients who have smoking-related comorbidities, oftentimes have renal insufficiency. And so the same drug in a different patient population, of course, can behave differently, and we need to pay attention to that.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. And we actually have a great question, very insightful, from our audience. So we're talking about the frontline options. Now we've had a patient with EV Prembro. All this great information, not sure if it's ready for prime time. What is your go-to next treatment? Thank you for the audience member who asked that. Dr. Golsky?
So after frontline EV Pembro, what's the next line treatment?
That's right. And yes. Would you consider a single agent IO even?
So after EV Pembro, if a patient has progressed, then I would hesitate to use a single agent IO if they progressed on prior Pembro. Platinum-based chemotherapy has sort of become a default, but really that's a default. We don't have data in that setting. I think, you know, patients with metastatic urothelial cancer should have tumor testing for FGFR3 mutations. This is a target with a drug that's shown to have activity and benefit in terms of time to event endpoints. We have trastuzumab deruxtecan approved one in patients with IHC 3+ overexpression of HER2. So testing for HER2, testing for FGFR3 mutations, and then thinking about platinum-based therapy versus those other two options based on the presence of those targets.
Yeah. No, I think that's really wonderful. And another question actually from one of our Zoom participants, I had to do a double take because I wasn't sure if it was a prostate cancer question. Mm-hmm. Because the question is, what if you're going along and you actually achieve a CR with, let's say, EV Pembro, Dr. Freelander, would you radiate maybe a few oligometastatic lesions for this patient? Yes, we're in the urothelial section still, folks, so not prostate just yet.
Yeah, so there is more data for oligometastatic radiation in prostate. There's some prospective studies that have suggested benefit there. We really don't have great studies of oligometastatic radiation in bladder cancer, but we do it. And that's because I tend to do it when I really don't have other options, or if for palliative reasons, if it's a big tumor, if it's causing pain, a bone metastasis, for example. I'm not a big fan of just irradiating patients after having a CR or a very good PR, and that's partly based on my experience with EVP. I have patients who are 7 years out from EVP who've had very good PRs. They have thickening in the bladder, or they have a lymph node that never quite reached a CR definition but really shrank down. I think there's no technically right answer here. And I think if your gestalt is that there truly is some viable disease left that's maybe refractory, then yeah, I would give radiation. I mean, there is some toxicity to radiation. I know it's fairly easy to give, especially SBRT. But I think we have to be a little cautious about just sort of over irradiating. And I've actually seen case reports of patients who had upper tract urothelial cancer, had excellent responses, and then went to get a nephrectomy. Wow, and a ureterectomy, and it was all, you know, just fibrotic tissue. Yeah. And so I'm not really sure if there was a benefit to removing that patient's kidney. I'm not really sure what we accomplished there.
Well, I think, again, it's always the patient first, and, you know, how do you tailor some of these now terrific options? So, Dr. Golsky, another common scenario is what was asked here from the survey respondent of a patient who's 62 with metastatic bladder cancer, status post EV Pembro, but then also had GemCis, and now continue to progress. So did what you just sort of recommend with HER2 testing and FGFR testing hold in this scenario as well?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, those would be the first two things that I would think about. Mm-hmm. And then in the absence of a therapeutic target, then of course a clinical trial would be very appropriate in this setting. And in the absence of available clinical trial for a patient who wasn't eligible for a trial, you know, if you look at the curves from EV301 with taxane-based chemotherapy, there are patients who respond to taxane-based therapy. It's a small subset, and that certainly warrants a discussion about risk versus benefit. But this is still a treatment in our armamentarium. Yeah.
Well, and I think that's, again, the second question. Do you ever want to re-challenge with EV And I'm not sure in exactly what context that is, but I think as the neoadjuvant data sort of ramps up in this scenario, is this something you'd consider again, Dr. Galsky?
Yeah, so I think in, you know, this gets to that question about rechallenging with IO as well. So first, I view rechallenge differently in a patient who's received these treatments in the perioperative setting versus receive them in the metastatic setting and progressed on treatment. Mm-hmm. So if you progress off treatment, that's different to me than if you progress on treatment. And of course, the timing might matter a little bit. Yeah. But one of the pieces of data that has informed my thinking about this a little bit are these patterns with ctDNA in the large colon cancer experiences. And in colon cancer, in patients who have MRD testing on adjuvant therapy, there are really these three patterns of change, right? There are patients who have clearance of ctDNA. Mm-hmm. There are patients who don't clear at all. And then there are patients who have transient clearance. And transient clearance to me means that some patients treated in the adjuvant setting have a response to treatment. They're just not cured. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're resistant to that drug if they progress off of it later. Mm-hmm. And so I think going back to a drug that someone hasn't progressed on is a reasonable thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Friedlander, I think that third question is something that sort of puts two of the things that I've asked you earlier, which is, okay, well, what if you're already on avelumab maintenance because you've gone down that way? Is this something you then would jump in and do EV pembro? Is EV alone sufficient?
Yeah, I mean, we don't really know the right answer here. You know, if you read the textbook, if you look at guidelines, it says EV monotherapy is a third line agent. Although the approval for EVP is broad, it's not limited to the frontline setting. We obviously need better data to tell us what IO does after IO. I mentioned some of the retrospective data that suggests there's not a lot of benefit to giving the pembrolizumab. There's probably not a lot of harm either because the patient's already been exposed to IO. So if they're going to have an IO-related side effect, they've probably already had it. There is financial toxicity to adding pembrolizumab for what may be a long treatment course. So I talk about this with the patient. You know, sometimes they're helpful in guiding this. Sometimes, you know, patients are not equipped with, I mean, we don't have the knowledge, so I shouldn't expect the patient to have the knowledge. So it's sort of a discussion with the patient. And I've done both. I've given EVP after IO, even though I harbor a lot of doubts about the value of giving the pembro. We really need to have some kind of prospective data. It's going to be take time to gather that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, again, shows that the three of us perhaps would approach each patient differently. So one of the big take-homes from, you know, conferences like this is data that's being discussed and shared should really be tailored to your patient in your practice with your team. And in this case, another question here is a patient in his 70s with a ECOG of 2. And we do see that in our metastatic bladder patients. This patient declined cystectomy and ended up having chemo radiation, did not want to do salvage cystectomy. Again, a common scenario. Started EV pembro, but really had a hard time, probably with a lot of the side effects that Dr. Friedlander had shared with us. Declined further chemo and now is just on single agent pembro. Dr. Galsky, what would you do?
Yeah, so for someone who is declining further cytotoxic chemotherapy and progresses on single agent pembro in this context, really the class of drugs that we have in urothelial cancer that's not necessarily chemotherapy are small molecule inhibitors of FGFR3. So I would certainly test for the presence of an FGFR3 mutation, and that becomes an option for this patient.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's absolutely right. I do want to point out that one of the struggles, and it's so nice to hear about the different options, but this is a frail group of patients. So the odds that we're going to make it past second line, Dr. Friedlander, did you want to comment on how not robust those numbers are?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned this earlier that, you know, about half, well, maybe I didn't, but half of patients who have metastatic urothelial cancer never get frontline therapy. These are elderly patients. Maybe they're in a nursing home. They get diagnosed with advanced disease and go straight to palliative care. And then from first line to second line, at least based on some data, there's about, you know, two-thirds of patients never make it to the second line. And again, two-thirds never make it to the third line. So it's only about 6% or so of patients who are making it to the third line, at least in data sets from, you know, the last maybe 10 years. That may be changing a little bit as we're getting better therapy and better kind of frontline, you know, bang for the buck. So it's hard to get people to late line therapy. And unfortunately, I talk about palliative care early on. You know, there's data from ASCO and ASCO plenary that showed that early palliative care has a survival benefit. And I think it's just a really important thing to remember. As much as we want, you know, we want to develop drugs that have really good activity, they also have toxicity, and we have to really balance that.
So Dr. Golsky, knowing these challenges, we're always worried with molecular testing, I know I am, that it takes time, especially if you're doing it on tissue. You have to get it maybe from a different outlying hospital. When do you test and how often do you test? Are these mutations changing like they do in prostate cancer or other cancers?
So the quote-unquote actionable mutation that we have in urothelial cancer is in FGFR3. That tends to be an early alteration that doesn't change. And so I don't test more than once.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, NCCN guidelines recommend considering testing for patients with stage 3B disease, so muscle-invasive bladder cancer, stage 3B disease. And then in patients, of course, frontline metastatic setting to test in that situation if you haven't already. One of the reasons for testing in that earlier stage is for the reasons that you bring up, because it takes time to locate the tissue, send it, and get the results. And so having that information in hand is quite helpful in decision making.
Yeah. So Dr. Golsky, one of our questions here from our participants online is, what is the absolute minimum testing that you do? So let's say you just don't have access to molecular testing of the fancy types. Is IHC testing really good enough to be able to give a medication like trastuzumab, deruxtecan?
Yeah, so if we think about what ADCs do, they're designed to bind to targets based on protein expression. And so for an ADC, it sort of makes sense that IHC testing would be appropriate. So I think the data is robust enough to use IHC for that specific treatment decision. Of course, you can't use IHC to make a decision about the presence of a somatic mutation in FGFR3, at least not yet. There are some AI-based tools that might be able to increase our ability to know who has a high likelihood of having an FGFR3 mutation, but not there quite yet.
Wonderful. Well, we can't get to all the questions, but as I remind the audience here and virtually, all of the slides are there, so please feel free to go back and look at perhaps some of your answers to these questions that are relevant to all of our practice. I want to thank Drs. Friedlander and Golsky. Let's give them a round of applause for all of their hard work. Thank you so much, and I'll have you gentlemen exit the stage, and I would like to invite Dr. Armstrong and Dr. Agarwal to join me as we switch to a discussion on prostate cancer. So we're switching gears. Now we're going to talk about prostate cancer, and we will have Dr. Armstrong start this next module talking about the evolving role of treatment intensification with AR pathway inhibitors for both non-metastatic and metastatic prostate cancer.
Thank you.
Go for it, Dr. Armstrong.
And hi, Neil, and thank you for the invitation to be here with you tonight, and thanks to the audience for sticking with us. I know it's late, and some of you are East Coasters. So,
that's right.
So I'm going to start us off with hormone-sensitive disease. It's one of the areas where prostate cancer has changed the most rapidly over the past 5 years. And we'll start with some of the major updates. So the major updates are moving into earlier and earlier settings where outcomes continue to improve with treatment intensification. We'll talk about the EMBARK data, which led to a recent FDA approval in the past year. We have extended follow-up, so we have long-term efficacy now from all of the ARPI trials. That's now the preferred term, the AR pathway inhibitors. So we'll be talking about STAMPEDE, LATITUDE, ARCHES, ENZAMET, TITAN, some of that updated data. And then we'll be talking about the newest kid on the block, darolutamide, from the ARANOTE and the ARASENS trial. So a lot of data to share. I put it in as a summary slide here, you know, to show you all the level one evidence that's been generated over the past 5 years that has led to both FDA approvals, NCCN guideline recommendations, and real evidence base to really show that treatment intensification for patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer is really the standard of care, improves survival. But I put at the top radiation to the primary. We can't forget about that. You know, 5 years ago, radiation oncologists were really left out of the treatment paradigm when the general feeling was that the horse was out of the barn. You know, the prostate cancer, once it had spread, the general feeling was that treating the primary did not benefit patients. And we learned from the STAMPEDE trial through randomization to treatment or not treatment that radiation does improve survival. And if you look at the hazard ratio for that low volume patient with synchronous disease, hazard ratio is 0.68. That's as good as our best systemic therapy. So we really have to put it right up there with our best systemic therapies. Now, whether treatment of metastatic sites can provide a similar survival benefit as treating the primary remains to be seen. That's going to be generated over the next 5 years. Now, enzalutamide, docetaxel, apalutamide, and abiraterone each have survival benefits with hazard ratios really similar to each other, 0.66, 0.68. Very similar, you know, all very robust. And if you look at the median improvements, the relative improvements, these are really testifying to a greater benefit when these ARPs are used early versus when they're used later. A survival benefit with early use suggests extra years of life instead of extra months of life. So I think patients can all value that approach. And it makes sense because one of the main mechanisms of resistance to androgen deprivation therapy is rewiring of the AR. The AR gets amplified and undergoes splice variants, genomic structural rearrangements, mutations, and these same drugs are just less effective in a rewired setting where there's more genomic instability, where there's more tumor suppressor losses, lineage plasticity, many other factors that limit the efficacy of the ARPIs. Now, doublet therapy as a minimum has become standard of care, and in my practice, I would say it's 90-95% of patients will get at least doublet therapy. It's never going to be 100%. ADT is probably reasonable. As Tanya Dorf had a very elegant discussion today, that there's that bucket of patients that are very elderly, frail, where ADT, even intermittent ADT, may be reasonable for some of these patients. But most patients want to live longer. They can tolerate the ARPIs, and they should be offered that. Now, at the bottom, I put the two triplet trials that have dedicated evidence showing that ADT, ARPI, and a taxane, docetaxel, for 6 cycles, extend survival over ADT plus docetaxel. So not testing docetaxel over an ARPI, but rather that triplet combination, each showing survival benefits predominantly in the synchronous high-volume patient population. So a very simple algorithm that Dr. McManus and I published in JCO is a nice separation by disease volume, with disease volume based on conventional imaging, CT, MRI, and bone scan. The ECOG charted criteria for high-volume disease means visceral metastases or 4 or more bone metastases, with at least 1 being outside of the central skeleton. So that's high volume. And then within high volume, you have synchronous or metachronous disease. Synchronous means de novo. It's presented at the same time as diagnosis. Metachronous means relapsed after local therapy. So obviously, treating the primary is most important when you have synchronous disease and when you have low volume disease. And triplet therapy is going to have a greater evidence base for the high volume patients that have a worse prognosis. Doublet therapy is scattered throughout all of these, and really the preferred ARPI is going to be based on comorbidities, preferences, costs, toxicities, and drug-drug interactions rather than comparative efficacy at this time. Let's move into the earlier setting. So all the success with the ARPIs in the castration-resistant setting, moving from metastatic to non-metastatic and then into the metastatic hormone-sensitive setting, spurred the EMBARK trial, which is now one of the earliest phase 3 studies to take patients with no conventional metastases on imaging, CT, bone scan, MRI. PSA doubling time is rapid in these patients. Less than 9 months is really a predictor of a higher metastasis-free survival and a higher risk of death. And these patients all have relapse disease, PSA that's rising after radical prostatectomy or radiation or both. And they're randomized to treatment according to either the doublet, ADT plus ENZA, ENZA monotherapy, or the traditional ADT monotherapy. Now, patients were treated for about 9 months. Once remission was obtained, defined by a PSA threshold of 0.2 or less, they went on a treatment holiday. So one of the great things about the EMBARK study is they didn't just treat forever. They gave a treatment holiday, and when patients had a relapse with a PSA that rose back up to about 5 with radical prostatectomy and radiation, they would resume the therapy. And this was a phenomenally successful study for its primary endpoint of metastasis-free survival and known surrogate of overall survival. The doublet therapy was probably the most successful arm. You can see in the upper curve that 87 versus 71% of patients were free of metastasis or death at 5 years. And again, this is with not continuous therapy. This is with a period of time without therapy. And I show on the right the median duration of treatment suspension. So the enzalutamide combination with ADT was about almost 21 months that patients spent on their first treatment holiday, where they were able to stop treatment and not have to resume. So that is a valuable time that is worth communicating to patients. Now, enzalutamide monotherapy also got FDA approval based on this. You can see that it was also more successful than ADT monotherapy. One of the limitations of enzalutamide monotherapy is that testosterone remains very high. So when you stop this drug, it has a relatively short half-life, and testosterone is going to be higher as a reflex. And so that treatment-free interval when you stop enzalutamide is going to be shorter. You can see on the right-hand side, it's only 11 months. 11 months is still a good treatment interval, but it's not as good as 20 months. So you just have to counsel patients. And if patients have a contraindication to ADT, or they don't like ADT, or had intolerance to ADT, enzalutamide monotherapy is a reasonable option, with the downside also being the side effect of gynecomastia, which is about 30 to 40% of patients, which is not a side effect with the doublet. I would point out that that leuprolide or ADT monotherapy is still a good choice for some patients. 50% of those patients treated with intermittent ADT in this non-metastatic setting are still alive and without metastatic disease 8 years later. So if you have a more elderly, frail patient, it's not unreasonable to counsel them about the risk benefits of any of these approaches. All of this new data has left us with more questions. We have questions about, well, what about PSMA PET positivity? You know, most of these EMBARK patients, if you look at that population, do a PET scan, about 80% are actually M1 by PET scan. How do we mash up some of our best approaches of oligometastatic radiation that we've seen from the STOMP trial or the ORIOL trial? Many of the studies that are presented today in posters, you know, for example, showing that you can delay progression. The oral abstract in the CRPC session from Canada really showed you can double the amount of time with enzalutamide, you know, just by radiating up to 5 metastatic sites. So how do we mash up those best approaches to benefit our patients and allow more patients perhaps to stop the systemic therapy and enjoy time and quality of life in remission without treatment? So a lot of that is ongoing. Another question is, are there biomarkers that can identify the patients that would benefit from triplet therapy? There was some provocative data from Stampede looking at various Decipher phenotypes. These are RNA expression profiles, such as the luminal phenotype, that suggests that some patients benefit from docetaxel if they have a proliferative phenotype. And so a lot of work is ongoing to identify those patients. Optimal candidates for prostate radiation, you know, clearly the low volume patients are benefiting, but the PEACE 1 trial not showing that data, you know, very much a more modern randomization, abiraterone for all patients. It did support the palliative benefit of radiation to the primary, even for high volume patients. And many of those patients do benefit because you're preventing obstruction, you're preventing percutaneous nephrostomy tubes, you're preventing a deterioration in quality of life. I just want to put in a plug for some of the MDT therapy trials. The VA is doing a great job with this very large randomization in the metastatic hormone-sensitive setting to best systemic therapy, which is ADT-ARPI, versus that same systemic therapy with metastasis-directed radiation. And CRPC-free survival is the primary endpoint. I would say it's playing on the Extend study, which is, you know, one of the first randomizations to test MDT, where patients were given intermittent ADT and randomized to that combined approach or not. Many of these patients had their metastases identified on PET scans, and many of these patients were also receiving an ADT plus an ARPI, and you can see from these Kaplan-Meier plots that the combined therapy significantly delayed progression. So it's really an option for some patients, not in the NCCN guidelines. This is off-label right now.
Well, and maybe before you provide all those updates in the interest of time, we may want to go and really learn about what you noted, which was darolutamide, the new kid on the block, and what your thoughts are on perhaps informing our audience
Let's go right to darolutamide. So, you know, as we're seeing all the data I've already basically shown with abiraterone and the high volume and the low volume patients benefiting, we have data that these drugs work better in the non-metastatic setting. We have data from NCCN that suggests that abiraterone shouldn't be just used in the metastatic setting, but should be used in the non-metastatic setting. We have long-term data from all the ARPI studies. This is just ARCHES, showing that patients are living longer. But the newest kid on the block, and I'm just going to go right to darolutamide, is this agent. So darolutamide is really a different chemical structure. It doesn't enter the blood-brain barrier. It's a very effective ARPI, binds to the ligand binding domain. It was first studied in Aramis, got FDA approval for non-metastatic CRPC. It was studied as part of a triplet combination in Aricens. It was very successful, as you can see, with overall survival, and this was the initial FDA approval. You can see here that by disease volume, that triplet really was most efficacious here on the left, which is the high-volume patients, much less efficacious in extending life in the low-volume patients. But it did so without a lot of toxicities. This was really a very successful study where the darolutamide really didn't add a lot of toxicities to a hormonal therapy regimen. So ARANOTE was really the first darolutamide doublet study. This was largely conducted ex-US because we'd already established many of these ARPI benefits in the US and we had these drugs available. Darolutamide versus placebo, very similar to many of the phase 3 studies that have already been conducted. This was a global randomized trial that was largely de novo and high volume, but had a good mixture and diverse patient population, as you can see here. Now, ARANOTE, this was published in JCO by Fred Saad. He just showed me today that he got a letter from the JCO editor. This is the most cited paper in JCO of the year. Oh. So this obviously has caught the attention of the global community. It's been adapted into NCCN guidelines largely because of this slide, you know, showing that darolutamide significantly reduced the risk of radiographic progression or death by 46%. So that's a real home run for patients who can receive this agent over ADT. You know, this is not surprising. We know this is an effective agent. This data mirrors many of the trial that I've already shown on the first slide. We have benefits, though, regardless of disease group, regardless of age, regardless of race, regardless of geographic localization, regardless of Gleason score. I think the most impressive data, and probably why this is so highly cited and of interest, is the clean toxicity sheet. So here we're seeing darolutamide with very few toxicities above a placebo, you know, with hot flashes and fatigue probably being the predominant ones, slightly increased risk of fracture. We know that long-term hormonal therapy can prevent, can promote bone density loss, osteopenia, osteoporosis, but really no cognitive effects, no falls, no increased risk of significant fractures and no drug rash, which is kind of a liability for some of the other agents. So really exciting, you know, that's accompanied by time to CRPC delays, time to pain progression. And so this suggests that we now have many choices when we're facing our patients. And I put up here just like one final slide as you're in the clinic trying to make a choice between you have abiraterone, which requires prednisone, has mineralocorticoid excess. Liver and electrolyte monitoring is required, a lot of cardiovascular risk, as you've heard. But on the other hand, it's become cheap and generic. There's a food effect, which can really reduce the price by 75%. It is safe and very effective and probably has the longest-term safety data. The utamides, you know, all the AR ligand binding domain inhibitors, there is no prednisone required. There is still exercise and bone density monitoring required to really minimize risk. There's still a little bit of hypertension, but not as much of those cardiovascular risks as you see with abiraterone necessarily. All can be safely given with radiation, by the way.
Well, and maybe just to, I think in the interest of time, mm-hmm. I want to make sure we have, because there's some burning questions from our medical oncology respondents. And I'll tell you the one that's the burning question. And again, all the slides are available to all of our participants. It's this top one. When are you going to use single agent enzalutamide, Dr. Armstrong, versus double? Or in what scenario are you making this in a biochemical relapse patient who's actually doing just great after you just told us all about these different side effects that we can expect?
So my default has been to offer the doublet, but that doesn't mean that every patient fits that bill. You know, mm-hmm. some patients will have had a prior experience with ADT, mm-hmm. and some patients will have had a miserable experience with ADT. And for that patient, enzalutamide offers a choice of an alternative, a more effective alternative than ADT, in fact.
Dr. Agarwal, do you agree with Dr. Armstrong?
I always agree with him.
Okay, that's probably the right answer. That's why we call him the mayor. But to put you a little more on the spot, in what scenario do you ever give single agent enzalutamide in this group?
That's you.
Me? That's you, Dr. Agarwal.
So I have a lot of patients, especially on the younger side, who are very nervous about starting ADT, and they start one injection, have severe side effects. In those patients, if they realize, as Andy just said, these patients have very high testosterone levels, mm-hmm. if they're getting enzalutamide. So I start them on enzalutamide, hold off on ADT injection, and tell them, if you have side effects, you stop and you recover from the side effects within weeks, if not days. So I think this is very comforting to our patients, mm-hmm. that you can recover from the side effects very quickly. So those are the cases.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, a helpful suggestion for sure. So, Dr. Armstrong, you talked about all the different side effects. Here's one respondent who was worried about gynecomastia with enzalutamide. Is that something you're seeing, especially in this, you know, well, M0 kind of scenario here? What are you suggesting or what are you counseling these men?
Yeah, if you look at the EMBARK follow-up, I mean, you're talking about 8 or 10 years where they're on these doublets and so or singlets. So enzalutamide monotherapy on or off for that long of a period of time, the report of gynecomastia is nearly half of patients. And so even painful gynecomastia in 20-30%. So prophylactic breast radiation is very low radiation. It's very safe, it's very well tolerated, and it's best in the preventative setting rather than in the reactive setting. So I have that discussion up front. And so I would consider it prophylactically. Some patients who don't want to consider that, I've occasionally prescribed tamoxifen, but again, that's like giving two drugs. Most patients don't want more pharmacologic therapies, but that has been shown to reduce the risk of gynecomastia.
And you may want to comment about this replacement of enzalutamide with Daro. Maybe comment on already the existing Daro indication.
Yeah, so darolutamide as monotherapy was studied by Matt Smith in an early study, and gynecomastia was a problem there too. So you don't get out of the woods by switching.
It's a thought. But yes, I think that's helpful to know. And I think a lot of the questions we're seeing from our medical oncology colleagues are about toxicities, because we do see so many more prostate cancer patients than perhaps bladder cancer in our practice. I think we are very mindful that we don't want to make patients feel worse when there are other options. So same thing here. Many patients do not tolerate the full dose. Do you start high and go low, or do you start low and go high? Dr. Agarwal.
So like any other anti-cancer therapy, dosing matters. So I never preemptively reduce the dose of any drug. We always start with the recommended dose and then monitor closely. So if elderly patients are there with 75 years plus and who I think are at a high risk of fall, fatigue, I monitor them closely and reduce the dose if they have those symptoms. But I don't preemptively reduce the dose.
Dr. Armstrong?
I agree with that. Now, there are patients who may be older but still very fit, and you may have younger patients who don't exercise at all. So you do have to be careful, and it's more about biologic age and frailty indices mm-hmm. than the actual age. But yes, usually it's the older, more frail patients that I'm more worried about, but I agree with starting with the recommended dose and then backing off, because a lot of patients will surprise you. They'll be motivated. Sure. They'll start proactively going to the gym, taking their calcium and D, and you know, a diagnosis of recurrent prostate cancer or metastatic disease can really change somebody's life.
Well, and I'll just say I completely disagree with both of you. I actually have a different practice mm-hmm. where I start at half dose and I go very slowly, and the men feel they're in control, and if they can tolerate it for a couple of weeks, they're happy with the dose escalation, and we're very proactive in that management. In the past, when I used to start at full dose, and the minute they don't feel well, they just don't want to come back to it. So I think here's a little bit of the art of medicine, mm-hmm. knowing who you're serving, your patient population, and in that case, I think having different experiences that many of us who do see a lot of prostate cancer patients, it's really helpful.
Yeah.
And here, I think they're, you know, this is pressing the question, is there any ARPI that stands out as the best in class, Dr. Armstrong?
So the efficacy of these ARPIs have never been compared really head-to-head outside of a small Canadian study, which showed that Abby and Enza had pretty identical efficacy in the first-line setting and for survival. There is suggestions, if you just look across hazard ratios, for slightly different relative differences, but in terms of overall survival, we really don't have head-to-head comparisons. Best in class from a patient-centric perspective would be about toxicity, therefore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, of course, we have to follow the evidence, and if we have an ARPI, and if you have choices where there's equal efficacy, I think you fall back onto the availability, cost, and toxicity is really what's driving most patient selection. I think darolutamide probably has the best-in-class toxicity if I had to pick one.
Well, and I think a question from the audience, and certainly the three of us have published on this topic as well, of just we're talking about treatment intensification. Your first slide is a terrific information slide for all of you to always go back to. But the reality is treatment intensification is not happening as widely as we'd like, despite all the level one evidence. So I think events like this is really important to sort of solidify that. But thoughts on sort of the lack, it's not even close to 50, 60%. So what are your thoughts on how we can do better?
I think that data that comes from community, I mean, identifies certain patient factors like where you live, rural versus urban, who you get seen by, a comprehensive cancer center versus the community, your access to care, who you see, medical oncologist versus urologist. There are certain predictors of that lack of treatment intensification. Mm-hmm. That is improving. Every time I see the data, it continues to improve. I don't think it'll ever be 100%. You know, even in the mm-hmm. academic, you know, ivory tower, it's not everybody that we see is perfect for doublet or triplet therapy. So I think probably a sweet spot will be 80 to 90% ideally. But the patients that we see, they're already self-selected for being able to drive to our academic centers and mm-hmm. consult with us. And those in the community who may have financial barriers, may have structural barriers, may have more comorbidities. I don't think it's going to be for everybody.
Well,
I'd just like to add, please. We are presenting in ASCO GU, Dr. Swami is the lead author, that the intensification has reached up to 77% right. in Flatiron data set, which is mostly medical oncology data set. But this is very comforting to see reaching up to 80% now.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. And I think that's with a concerted effort with meetings like this and grassroots efforts mm-hmm. to really inform our colleagues. You know, to that end, when would you use a triplet? As Dr. Armstrong has mentioned, you know, Dr. Agarwal, do you give triplets versus doublets? And in what scenario do you do either?
A very small number of patients, patients who have liver metastasis. These are 7 to 8% patients. And I'll be honest with you, if I see this P10 loss, RB loss, P53 loss, so if I see RB loss alone, I usually go with docetaxel. If I see both P53 and P10 loss, I go with docetaxel. So there are 20% of patients in my clinic who get triplet Otherwise, I think ADT plus ARPI are pretty good for all category of patients, as also shown by the STOP-CAP-M1 database today by Dr. David Fisher.
Right.
Yes, that was a terrific discussion, and thank you both so much for answering, you know, these types of questions. We are going to move on to the last module of the evening. Thank you, all of you, also virtually still remaining with us, because we had a wonderful talk from Dr. Agarwal today, and he'll educate us again on the optimal integration of PARP inhibitors in this scenario in prostate cancer. Dr. Agarwal?
Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Love. We miss you here. We always like to see you, but hello from the distance. And to all those hundreds of attendees on the Zoom call, we'll try to keep it as interesting as possible. So this is about PARP inhibitors. So this is a learning objective. We want to know the biological rationale for combining these two drugs. Phase 3 trial data, results from phase 2 BRCAway data, or BRCAway trial, and then ongoing trials. Before I move to the discussion of PARP inhibitors, we have seen questions this morning, like, what is the utility of this doublet, enzalutamide plus talazoparib, when most people have received ARPI in the past? And I wanted to show this picture, which partly was addressed by Dr. Armstrong, that many of the patients do not develop mCRPC from mHSPC. In fact, de novo mHSPC or synchronous metachronous HSPC only happen in less than 10% patients in the US, and then 20 additional percent patients develop mHSPC from metachronous disease, but vast majority of patients we see in the community by our community colleagues get PSA recurrence after localized radiation therapy or surgery. They get intermittent ADT, continuous ADT, and then slowly develop mCRPC. There is another, and of course, we see a lot of mHSPC patients who do not get ARPIs. Fortunately, that proportion is increasing in number. But now we are going to see a wave of new type of patients who got ARPIs for a limited duration in the past. For example, a STAMPE trial, 2 years of abiraterone, or 2 years of enzalutamide, darolutamide, apalutamide in various trials combining these agents for radiation therapy. And many of these patients, I would say about 50%, just an estimate, will not recover their testosterone after this initial therapy and will develop mCRPC without really progressing on an ARPI. So I think there is going to be a substantial number of patients who are going to be candidates for ARPI treatment after onset of metastatic CRPC. That doesn't mean we should not think about intensifying upfront, but that also means we will continue to have the role of ARPI in the mCRPC setting in the near future. I would like to talk about this second slide really quick before going to the PARP inhibitors. One of the reasons combination therapy or combining therapies work in metastatic prostate cancer is because these patients get two therapies instead of one therapy up front. And as we can see here, almost 10,000 patients, it is disheartening to see that half of the patients don't receive the subsequent line of therapy. We have more than, I think, 7 or 8 drugs approved in mCRPC setting. And really, in the US, we are seeing only one systemic line of therapy being received by our patients with metastatic CRPC. So again, combination therapy works, whether it is mHSPC setting, as Dr. Armstrong described, or early on in mCRPC setting, because we get to have these patients receive both two therapies or three therapies together. So let's look at the PARP inhibitor ARPI. Why should we combine them? There's preclinical evidence, and the way I explain to my patients, you block the AR with enzalutamide, darolutamide, apalutamide, and AR basically calls PARP to help itself, and PARP comes to the support of AR. So PARP works as a support system for AR. So if you block the AR with ARPI, and at the same time block the PARP with PARP inhibitor, that can lead to a an onset of BRCAness, if you will, where patients do not necessarily have these HRR gene alterations, but they can have a functional BRCAness. And again, preclinical evidence, so it's not phase 3 trial, but I'll show you them some phase 3 data in a moment. So these are the phase 3 trials, one of them led by Dr. Armstrong right here. One is Magnitude, and last is STALA-PRO2. And this is the PROPEL trial result. We saw that patients were randomized, very similar to STALA-PRO2, which I discussed this morning. Patients of newly diagnosed mCRPC randomized to abiraterone plus olaparib versus abiraterone plus placebo. The primary endpoint was met. Radiographic progression-free survival was 8 months longer. The overall survival was about very similar to STALA-PRO2 trial, I would say. It just did not meet the pre-specified statistical boundaries of statistical significance. But again, proof of principle, we are seeing very similar trend in an all-comer patient population. And if you look at the HRR mutation positive versus negative patients, we are seeing some benefit in patients who do not have HRR mutation, maybe not as striking or as similar to, you know, Magnitude trial is different, so I'll come to that trial in a moment, but very similar to what we see with STALA-PRO2 trial. Side effects, mostly nausea and vomiting. I don't let any patient go home with anti-nausea medication when I'm starting them on olaparib. This is the Magnitude trial. It was a different trial. It was basically two trials. Patients either had HRR mutations by tissue testing or did not have HRR mutations. And in patients who had HRR mutation, who did not have HRR mutations, pretty much there was no benefit, and trial was halted early. Patients who had HRR mutations present, BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation positive prostate cancer patients showed the maximum benefit. It was not as strong as we saw with the PROPEL trial as far as all HRR mutation positive patients were concerned. So it looks like there may be a difference in the efficacy as far as abiraterone-niraparib combination is concerned versus abiraterone plus olaparib is concerned. And we know there was a 33% dose reduction of niraparib up front, and we know dosing matters with PARP inhibitor. We are not sure what happened across the trial. Comparison is not fair, but we see less magnitude of benefit with niraparib-based combination. As I said, HRR-negative patients did not have any benefit, and now we come to the final analysis. Most of the benefit was basically seen in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 patients. This is a pre-specified analysis adjusting for the baseline factors, and it shows benefit in BRCA1 and BRCA2 positive patients. One of the unique side effects, in addition to what we see with PARP inhibitor, is cardiovascular side effects, hypertension, arrhythmias, but they are happening in very small number of patients. So niraparib remains a pretty good, well-tolerated drug like any other PARP inhibitor. Coming to the STALA-PRO2 trial, we published these results last year after the RPFS data. Now I'm going to show you the updated data from today morning, like which I presented this morning. But this is the overall trial design. All-comer patient population, very similar to PROPEL. They were randomized to talazoparib plus enzalutamide versus placebo plus enzalutamide. I think the big difference was the addition of these HRR mutation-positive patients in the end. And I think that allowed us to better elucidate the magnitude of difference in patients who had HRR mutation positivity. All these patients had prior tissue testing, so prospective tissue testing done. That was a difference from the PROPEL trial. And radiographic progression-free survival was the primary endpoint. Overall survival was the key secondary endpoint, which was alpha-protected, meaning it was statistically powered for overall survival. We see that 100% of these patients had tissue testing done. BRCA1 and BRCA2 patient-positive patients only comprise 7% of these patients. There is no way BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation were driving the survival benefit here. We can see radiographic progression-free survival is 13 or 14 months improved. That's quite an improvement in radiographic progression-free survival in all this all-comer patient population. 19.5 months versus 33.1 months. Please note that in the PREVAIL trial, which led to approval of enzalutamide, the median PFS was 21 months or 20 months, if I'm not mistaken, very close. So this is an all-comer patient population, and basically adding 14 months to that, it's quite impressive in my view. Overall survival data showed positive overall survival benefit, more than about 9 months of improvement in survival, which is, again, quite striking. And we decided to better elucidate the efficacy of this combination in HRR-positive versus HRR-negative patients. So we did the stringent testing by both ctDNA and tumor tissue, and we saw in patients who did not have BRCA1 alterations, there was a 25% reduction in risk of death, and patients who did not have any HRR alterations, there was about 22% reduction in risk of death. Although we can argue that confidence interval crosses one in the HRR alteration negative patients, but this is a post hoc analysis to inform practice. This is not, the trial was not powered for this group. So I think there is benefit here. We just need to know who is benefiting better. And coming to the side effects, we did not see any new MDS AML, which was quite nice to see. And I'd really like to bring your attention to management of side effects. These patients, 49% patients had grade 1-2 anemia. And anemia, mostly grade 3 for anemia, happens 3 to 4 months after starting treatment. So what I do CBCs every month. Patients who are actually trending down to grade 3 for anemia, I tend to decrease the dose of talazoparib before they hit grade 3 for anemia. In the trial, we were not allowed to do that. And that's why we see a lot of grade 3 for anemia. But in real practice, we can easily reduce the dose in those patients, basically personalizing medicine before they develop grade 3 for anemia. Now, if you look at median duration of treatment with talazoparib, that's 20 months. It's quite long, with only 8% patients or 8.5% discontinuing talazoparib due to anemia. So I think the side effect of anemia is pretty well manageable as far as we follow these patients every month for first 3, 4, 5 months, and we know who needs to decrease the dose. I will not decrease the dose preemptively because half of the patients never develop grade 3 for anemia. So overall conclusion, increased overall survival, maintained RPFS benefit, no safety signal, so good treatment option. This is a summary of the trial for your own record. I will not go through this. Basically, this shows overall survival benefit in the TALAPRO-2 trial. I would like to bring your attention to the BRCA-WEI trial. We conducted this trial before all of these phase 3 trials were started. And why I'm showing this phase 2 trial, which is pretty small investigator-initiated trial, because that shows that combining is so much better, at least suggested by this trial data, than sequencing of these patients. So again, small trial, 20 patients in each arm, 20 patients got abiraterone, 20 patients got olaparib, and 20 of these got abiraterone plus olaparib. First of all, and this is progression-free survival, I would skip this. Let's see this. So abiraterone patients were switched to olaparib when they had disease progression. Olaparib patients switched to abiraterone when they had disease progression. And please note, half of these patients could not switch. We lost those patients. We are still getting into this detail on why only half of the patients were able to switch to second line of therapy. Assuming 100% patients switch, because this is half of the patients, almost 8 to 9 patients, they switched. Even if you assume everybody switched, the combined PFS of sequencing is 16 months. But look at the arm 3 where abiraterone was combined with olaparib. That's 39 months. And I think these data really helped me grasp the magnitude of or the benefit of combining rather than sequencing. Not only we lose patients, but I think there has to be some synergy as far as attack on the tumor biology is concerned. So with that, I would like to conclude my discussion by saying that this is just a start. TALAPRO-3 trial data will be coming soon. Amplitude trial data will be presented. These are hormone-sensitive trial, and I think it is a matter of time before we start talking about these agents in the hormone-sensitive setting. These are the three trials. This is the EvoPAR Prostate 1. This is using a new drug, saruparib. And then, of course, my take, all of these patients need NGS testing, because there are implications on the family, implication on the patients, and difference in magnitude based on what kind of mutations they have. So it is very important that we do continue to do NGS testing regardless of result of TALAPRO2 trial or the PROPEL trial. Thank you very much.
Fabulous. Wow, thank you so much. And I think many of us who were there at your discussion this morning are trying to really figure out how to integrate that in our practice. As sort of the second bullet here, there's a lot of discussion and even a recent meta-analysis that took all of those studies that you were talking about and trying to figure out, depending on what particular gene was actually mutated in the HRR family, that you would get different responses. I think this audience knows BRCA2 is clearly the driver, but the question here from our respondent was, well, what do we do with PALB2? And what do we do with ATM, which has been a lot of hand-wringing? So I'm going to rephrase that question of, do we need to do any hand-wringing at all, Dr. Agarwal? Or are we just going to say, well, we tested and here's this and everyone gets a doublet?
Yeah, I think magnitude of difference is much higher in BRCA2 and BRCA1, followed by HRR positive patients. There was a hazard ratio of 0.62, which is like 40% reduction. If you exclude BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation, we still saw survival benefit in that post hoc analysis. So my take on this, BRCA1, BRCA2, PALB2, RAD51, there are many genes, CDK12, hazard ratio was 0.5, so I'm using it in CDK12 positive patients, which is a very common gene mutation. Regarding the ATM, I have seen responses, but ATM is such a large gene. If it is a small mutation, may not affect the function of the gene. But I think we will hopefully show some compelling data in ASCO, which is only a few months away. And I think we'll have a better information on what to do in ATM positive patients. But for now, I will continue to use it in all patients who are HRR mutation positive.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Armstrong?
One little thing I'd like to just add, which I totally agree with, is that we've learned that some of our DNA repair alterations that we detect by ctDNA are actually CHIP, clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential, which is a false positive. You know, it's an age-related alteration in your hematopoietic stem cells, and that's a risk factor for myeloid leukemia, COPD, coronary artery disease, MI. It's very important to that patient to detect CHIP, but it's very important not to inappropriately give a PARP to a patient that has ATM CHIP or CHEK2 CHIP. I think we had a poster today that suggested somewhere between 25 and 33% of all of our DNA repair alterations are not in the tumor. So I think if you find a low-level, you know, variant in the blood, like plasma, and it's ATM or CHEK2 particularly, that you could look for a myeloid CHIP panel, you know, rule that out, or do some orthogonal tumor testing to see if it's really in the tumor, and that might help you avoid, you know, therapies that may do more harm than good for some patients. But
well,
I agree,
I'd just like to add.
Yeah, go ahead.
CHIP filters are being used now in multiple commercial testing.
Exactly.
So our colleagues in the community, I'm like, Dr. Armstrong runs a lab in this area. His expertise is hard to match. Even I don't have the depth of understanding you have, Andy. But many of my community colleagues who are seeing all 100 different types of cancer types, it's very difficult for them to figure out, like, you know, how to differentiate CHIP. So, like, fortunately, now CHIP filters are being applied by most of the CLIA certified companies, and you will not have to worry about false positive ATM and CHEK2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think it's great knowledge that you can also then advocate for your patients, and you can ask, when I do this testing for my patient, is there a CHIP filter being added, and where does that lie? So I think that's information that's really good, you know, for all of us. You know, part of the discussion also is we talked about somatic testing, germline testing. Dr. Agarwal, did you want to comment on, do you do both? Obviously, you made a statement today that metastatic prostate cancer patients should, and go ahead. Thoughts?
We just got the ASCO guidelines out January 9th. Please have a quick look at the paper. Nice summary of the recommendations. We wanted to make it very simple. please do germline testing and somatic testing for every patient with metastatic or locally advanced prostate cancer, so that we don't miss those devastating germline mutations, which can be present in 1/3 of patients with BRCA1, BRCA2, and many other mutations. And these, we can save lives by doing germline testing in the family members who are really young and healthy right now, but they will develop breast cancer or ovarian cancer if you don't detect them. So yes.
Yeah. Well, and I think we've touched on the first one there, just in terms of what do we do. And, you know, that's still a big take home. Come Monday morning when you're seeing your newly diagnosed mCRPC patient in good shape, are you going to be doing the combination? You didn't maybe even get the molecular testing results back. So I think it's an active discussion. Dr. Agarwal, how do you plan on sort of implementing that in your group?
Yeah. So I'm using the FDA label. I have to. We all have to. So I'm using it in HRR-positive patients. And let's see what regulatory bodies decide. And once we have the drug available, then we will have more discussion about who should be treated with this. So for now, HRR-positive patients.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important messaging. Again, there's all this tremendous amount of data, but come in clinic Monday morning, just know, you know, I mean, we could try it, but I think insurance and FDA approvals, all of these really, really matter. The other question is...
If I may add, we are actually trying to see who benefited. So in ASCO and AACR, we had an abstract. Yeah. It looks like patients who have AR activation, or for some reason AR is under stress, meaning they are more reliant on PARP, they seem to be benefiting, but very prelim manuscript has to come out, and then that may further help.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's really great. The next question here from our survey respondent, what are the practical applications really of the finding of these trials? And, well, in a way, to your point, are they really exposed to ARPs, and does it really matter the when and the length and so on and so on? So that's a very long type of question, but does it matter that you stop for toxicity? Does it matter that you progress? Does it matter that you've been on it for 3 years? Thoughts?
I'll keep it simple. Anytime we are thinking about starting an ARPI, regardless of whether we should combine PARP inhibitor or not. So in my practice, if a patient had not had progression, so I don't really care as much for exposure. I say, did they progress on an ARPI? So if somebody had got abiraterone and developed liver enzyme elevation 6 weeks after starting abiraterone, and we had to stop abiraterone, and we didn't do anything else, we see patients like this. Or who got 2 years of treatment with abiraterone in a stampede trial fashion with radiation therapy. When they develop mCRPC, they have not really progressed on an ARPI, so I consider ARPI for them over docetaxel chemotherapy. But patients who have really been failed by ARPI or did not have any response to ARPI, just blew through ARPI, I'm not going to use another ARPI in those patients. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a difference between exposed versus progressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dr. Armstrong, you're embarking away in your clinic. Thoughts?
I'll put in a little plug for Alicia Morgan's trial testing patients who have had prior ABI. Mm-hmm. They're randomized to talazoparib or talaenza. And so we'll learn from that trial, it's called the TALENT study, the answer to this question of what do you do for the BRCA patient who's progressing. I mean, outside of a trial, I would talk to that patient about ARPI switch and adding a PARPI, but we don't have strong evidence. Neeraj's trial had 6%, I think, prior ABI, so it wasn't a lot of patients, and although that 6% still did a bit better with the combination. Enza after ABI has about a 1/3 response rate, so it wouldn't be wrong to give it, you know, mm-hmm. give two drugs that are both potentially active just to fight for your patient, but sure. You'd have to go in with both, you know, with an honest discussion and informed decision-making that it's a gray area of medicine.
Yeah. So another question here. You have a 63-year-old with germline BRCA2, was put on ADT and ENZA, has metastasis to the bone, but couldn't tolerate that ENZA. So now you've got new bone lesions. What do you want to do next, Dr. Agarwal?
As I said, if they have not had disease progression on prior ARPI, I will offer them ARPI.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here, if he did progress...
And if they did progress, then of course, I will change the class of the drug. I hope we, docetaxel is there for 2 decades now. But I hope that we have lutetium-177 approved based on the PSMA-4 trial. I know we may be hearing about that soon. So that may be another option. And definitely, patients who have BRCA2 mutation, olaparib is an option. Mm-hmm. It works beautifully, irucaparib. They can add years to survival. So I wanted to mention PARP inhibitor in the last, just to mention that they are probably the most effective drug for patients who have BRCA2 and maybe BRCA1 mutation. So I'll use that.
Okay. Dr. Armstrong, should we think that the BRCAway study is adequate to think about sequencing or combination?
I think BRCAway addressed the, in a randomized way, sequencing. Didn't have a power to look at survival. It was PFS endpoint, PSA endpoints, but it was compelling because of the dropout rate that you see, that patients, when they progress, there's morbidity and mortality associated with progression. So the goal of patients is to stay alive and keep their progression at bay. And so see, the combination is really important.
Well, and I think as we've seen, especially Dr. Agarwal on your slides, we now have lots of choices for PARP inhibitors, either alone or in combination. How do you pick?
In reality, for the combinations, we will be picking up the combination based on the backbone ARPI. That's my feeling.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So a patient has received abiraterone for 2 years, and you're choosing enzalutamide, then enza can only be combined with talazoparib. We don't recommend mixing these ARPI plus PARP combinations. If you choose abiraterone for a patient who has never seen any ARPI, obviously, niraparib and olaparib are good options. Mm-hmm. And then drug interaction, copay, and so many other factors kick in our decision-making, which often force us to make a decision for one of those combinations. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a backbone ARPI choice, which is going to be defining, in most patients, the choice of the combination.
Dr. Armstrong, does it matter that you take less pills with a few of these because they're a combination? I'm sure some of our audience members may want to know your opinion on that. Or doesn't it not matter? Do you bring it up at all?
Yeah, my first mantra is efficacy and survival first, and safety is really important as part of the second piece of that equation. Mm-hmm. And I think, across the PARP inhibitor trials, you see very striking similar efficacy, at least for the PROPEL and TALAPRO trials. Mm-hmm. For the MAGNITUDE study, I think you alluded to this in your jokes about the lack of MAGNITUDE, you don't see as much. And so that would not be my default choice, and I have yet to use that approach. Now, you do have some patients who can't take the pills, but, it's hard to adjust combo pills, because you don't know which toxicity you're having sometimes, and mm-hmm. again, that combination may be less effective and more toxic than alternatives.
So in a particular mutation for this oncologist asking us, let's say it's ATM, do you say pass and just do something else like chemotherapy? Or, what's your next step, Dr. Armstrong?
Yeah, so ATM is a DNA damage sensor. It's not really a homologous repair deficiency at all. Mm-hmm. It's included in this quote panel, but it really derives from signaling around DNA damage sensing. And we're developing new inhibitors that may be mm-hmm. synthetic lethal with ATM carriers. And PARPs are not those. The objective response rate to PARP monotherapy in an ATM carrier is less than 10%. And the PFS is not great. And the FDA's own meta-analysis of the ARPI-PARPI combos in ATM carriers, the hazard ratio is very close to 1.
Yeah.
So not a strong synergy there. So we're looking for alternatives, enrollment of those patients on trials, and sticking with the proven therapies like docetaxel, cabazitaxel, PSMA lutetium, radium, mm-hmm. CYP-T. All of those can benefit those patients.
So Dr. Agarwal, I'll ask you the last question before we adjourn for the evening. This is a question from our audience. If a patient isn't tolerating one of the combinations, you try the other?
It's tolerating or not tolerating?
Not tolerating. So if you're not tolerating one, do you switch? You're not
progressing,
do you switch?
If not tolerating, it's easy decision. Yes, we switch. Yeah.
How about you, doctor? I said he was going to have the last word, but go ahead, Andy.
Well, yes, I agree with him. Neeraj is always right.
That's absolutely wonderful. Well, thank you all of you in the audience as well as our attendees virtually. I also would like to personally thank Neil Love for having all of us, including our two bladder colleagues earlier, to spend the evening with all of you. Thank you so much and have a good evening, everyone.